Welcome back to another deep dive. To you, our fellow learner listening right now, we are so thrilled you could join us today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to be here.
Because, well, if you are someone who regularly picks up a high fantasy story, you probably do it with a certain expectation of, like, escapism.
Right. Oh, for sure. You anticipate reading about ancient keeps and powerful wizards, majestic talking animals. You know, it's a comforting, predictable formula.
Yeah, exactly. The brave hero swings a sword, the dark lord falls down, and the realm is saved. I mean, the lines between good and evil are drawn in this thick, unmistakable ink.
And the appeal of that genre usually lies in its simplicity. It offers a very clear-cut, binary struggle that we rarely get to experience in our own messy, complicated lives.
But the stack of narrative logs we are exploring today completely shatters that simple formula.
It really does.
We're diving into a high fantasy setting called Mirari. But instead of offering you a comfortable escape, these sources present an absolute existential minefield.
Yeah, it's intense.
Our mission for this deep dive is to take this world of magic and swords and extract some surprisingly profound insights about human identity, the crushing burden of duty, and honestly, the sheer paralyzing dread of realizing your entire universe might just be a game played by someone else.
Yeah, that existential dread is heavy. And to set the scene, we really need to look at two central figures navigating this landscape.
Right.
First, there is Lord Explorer Thomas. He's this grizzled veteran leader, and he's currently marching his forces toward a highly ominous location known as the Destroyer's Keep.
Cheery name.
Right. And second, we have Hannah. She's a young woman from a noble family, House November. And Hannah has just made a monumental decision to abandon a very safe, comfortable new life as a Golden Hawk, which is a highly prestigious title, by the way, specifically to chase after Thomas and insert herself into his dangerous campaign.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the moment Hannah finally catches up to Thomas. Because they have this incredibly tense reunion in a firelit study in a place called Oberia.
Yeah, the tension in that scene is palpable.
And what stands out immediately is that Hannah isn't just some, like, impulsive kid running off to join the war. Her departure was a highly calculated strategic maneuver.
Oh, absolutely. She left a paper trail specifically designed to trap the adults around her into accepting her decision. Mm-hmm. Before abandoning her post, she wrote two specific documents, a personal note to her father and an open letter addressed to the lords and ladies of the ruling houses.
Which is such a bold move.
It is. And in that open letter, she casually mentions that the lady sorceress Nimue, who is this figure of immense magical and political power, approved of her plan to intercept Thomas.
Which is such a brilliant manipulative move. I mean, Hannah knows perfectly well that Thomas actively dislikes the sorceress.
Oh, he despises her.
Right. But she also knows that invoking the sorceress's name carries massive political weight with the lords.
Exactly.
Think about this in the context of, like, modern office politics.
Yeah.
It is the equivalent of a junior employee ceasing the CEO and the entire board of directors on an email stating they are transferring to a new department.
That is a perfect analogy.
Right. By the time the middle manager, in this case, Thomas, reads the email, the political momentum is already too big to stop without causing a massive scandal. She basically leverages the bureaucracy of her world to force his hand.
She boxes him in completely. And the crazy thing is, rather than being angry, Thomas actually chuckles.
Yeah, he respects it.
He does. He reveals that her entire journey to find him was actually a test he had orchestrated.
Wait, really? The whole thing?
The whole thing. He needed to push her to her absolute limits to see if she could stand her ground and remain unwavering against an authority figure. He had to know if her resolve was, you know, manufactured or genuine.
The natural question for you listening is probably, well, why go through all that trouble? Why put your allies through such extreme psychological stress?
And it comes down to the specific nature of the enemy they are fighting. This enemy is known as the Destroyer, and he completely redefines warfare in this setting.
Yeah, he's not your typical villain.
Not at all. The Destroyer does not just march a massive army of orcs to your front door. According to Thomas's warnings to Hannah, the Destroyer attacks the mind and the spirit.
Which is terrifying.
It is. He corrupts the people around you, twisting their loyalties, and forces you into situations where you literally have to fight your oldest, closest friends.
So because Hannah passes Thomas's brutal stress test, demonstrating her mental fortitude, he immediately assigns her an absolutely terrifying task.
Talk about a reward for passing a test, right?
I know. He orders her to return to the royal court. Her mission is to protect the king's daughter, Princess Angel, who currently goes by the name Alice, because everyone presumes the princess is dead.
Right.
But the terrifying catch here is that the destroyer is no longer waiting at his keep. He has already infiltrated the palace. He's walking the halls, disguised as a friendly noble named Lord April.
Which just changes the entire dynamic of the threat.
Completely.
Yeah.
If you want to understand the mechanics of this threat, look at it through the lens of modern cybersecurity.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, the destroyer's tactics are textbook high-level social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
If you talk to any security professional, they will tell you that the most dangerous attacks to a network almost never come from a brute force battering ram trying to smash through the firewall.
Right, they come from the inside.
Exactly. They happen because an employee trusted a disguised email link or, you know, held the door open for someone wearing a fake badge.
Yeah.
In Mirari, the destroyer is that fake badge.
He exploits human trust.
Yes. If your enemy is already inside the castle walls, having dinner with the royal family and wearing a friendly face, your physical armor and your swords are entirely useless.
What's fascinating here is how Thomas's entire leadership style has been warped by the trauma of fighting that exact kind of psychological war.
Yeah, he's so damaged by it.
He really is. He explicitly tells Hannah, quote, "I sought him out once, alone." Thomas isolates himself out of this deep-seated fear of attachment.
Because if you care about people, they can be used against you.
Exactly. If the destroyer weaponizes the people you love against you, the logical, albeit tragic, defense mechanism is to just stop loving people. You distance yourself.
Which is so sad.
It is. And contrast that profound isolation with Hannah, who operates by constantly building alliances, writing open letters, and it's such a great detail. So Hannah has been connecting a series of bizarre events across her world, and she has deduced a chilling theory. She suspects that Mirari is not an independent universe, but rather a construct directly influenced by what she calls the mortal realm.
Like our world.
Basically. The tragedies, the wars, the victories. She fears they are all governed by the arbitrary whims of a game being played by mortals in another dimension.
And then Bragwaine the cat, in the most casual manner possible, drops a piece of information that seemingly confirms her absolute worst nightmare.
Just completely shatters her worldview.
Right. The cat reveals that Mirari's king hasn't been killed or kidnapped by traditional means. The king is missing because he actually crossed over into that mortal realm.
Which has massive consequences.
Huge. Because the king is absent and unable to pass on the crown, Mirari is trapped in an endless, brutal winter. Imagine the sheer anxiety of that concept.
It's mind-boggling.
It is as if the server hosting your entire reality has been paused. The economy is failing, the weather is frozen, and everyone inside the system is suffering immensely, simply because the admin in another universe got up and walked away from the keyboard.
That is such a bleak reality to wake up to. Facing this unimaginable revelation, Hannah turns to Pelis, seeking a definitive answer. But Pelis deliberately refuses to confirm or deny the mechanics of the mortal realm.
He dodges the question.
He does. Instead of answering her literal question, he offers her a philosophical anchor. He tells her that regardless of whether mortals view the inhabitants of Mirari as phantoms, game pieces, or homunculi, she must hold on to one undeniable truth.
Which is?
That she is a witness to her own thoughts.
Mm.
He invokes the core principle of René Descartes cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Pelis insists that her awareness of her own soul makes her real, regardless of the universe's origin.
But I have to push back on Pelis' logic here.
Okay, let's hear.
Is he genuinely offering philosophical truth? Or is he just giving her a comforting lie to keep her functioning? Because if the mortals in this other realm truly control everything that happens in Mirari, down to the roll of a die, does Hannah's free will actually exist?
That's a million-dollar question.
Right. If every choice she makes is just a reaction programmed by the rules of a tabletop game, then telling her, you know, you think, therefore you are, feels like putting a Band-Aid on a gaping existential wound. The illusion of choice might just be part of her software.
This raises an important question, and the tension between free will and determinism is exactly what Pelis is trying to navigate.
Mm.
Pelis is not necessarily denying the existence of the game. He is actively warning Hannah against the paralysis of overanalysis.
Ah, okay.
If she dwells on the meta-narrative, if she fully internalizes the idea that her life is just a piece on a board, it will fundamentally alter her identity.
How so?
It will shift her from being an active, capable protector into a paralyzed, passive philosopher. She is about to walk into a palace to guard a princess from a master of psychological manipulation. Mirari simply cannot afford for Hannah to have an existential breakdown right now.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, Pelles is essentially saying that dwelling on the nature of the simulation will destroy her ability to survive within it.
So the survival strategy is forced compartmentalization. The rules of the universe don't matter right now. What matters is the action you take in the next 5 minutes.
Exactly.
It is a wild pivot to make mentally. And speaking of wild pivots and the malleability of identity, here's where it gets really interesting.
Ooh, yes.
Pelles warns Hannah that her thoughts could alter who she is, turning her from a warrior into a philosopher. But later in the logs, we encounter another character, Agatha, who decides to actively and intentionally change her identity.
Which is just incredible to read.
And she does it by literally weaponizing the narrative tropes of her own reality.
Yeah, Agatha's situation requires us to look at the intersection of memory and physical ability. She is currently sparring in a garden with Thomas.
And she's struggling.
She is. Agatha has a past persona, a highly lethal warrior identity known as Redmayne, and she desperately needs the combat instincts and suppressed memories of Redmayne to stand any chance against the Destroyer.
But she can't just flip a switch.
No, the problem is those instincts are locked away and she cannot access them through sheer willpower. During this sparring match, her frustration peaks to the point where she actually shatters Thomas's wooden practice sword in a fit of rage.
Realizing that conventional methods are failing, she demands what she explicitly calls a fairy tale solution.
I love this part.
It's so good. She lies back on a stone bench, closes her eyes, and instructs Thomas to kiss her. But we have to be clear here. There is zero romance in this gesture.
None whatsoever.
It is an entirely transactional, calculated move. Agatha understands the rules of the mortal realm that govern their world. She knows the tropes.
The fairy tale rules.
Right. She knows the stories of Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, where a true love's kiss acts as a mechanical key to break a spell. She tells Thomas that the kiss will work, but only if he genuinely believes it will work.
It requires this immense leap of faith that is deeply grounded in the structural mechanics of their universe.
Mm-hmm.
So Thomas leans in and delivers a very awkward, hesitant kiss, pleading quietly for his, quote, crazy old friend to come back to him.
And it works.
The astonishing part of this source material is that it actually works. The spell breaks. But the logs make it very clear that this is not merely a mental unlock where she suddenly, like, remembers how to hold a sword.
Not at all. It triggers a violent, physical, biological transformation.
It's so visceral.
Later on, when Agatha heads to the stables, she interacts with the majestic telepathic animals of this world, specifically Ahern, the Snow White Lord of the Horses, and Fiona, the Night Steed.
The best characters.
Honestly, yes. And these animals immediately detect the changes. They observe that she is physically taller, her facial structure has altered, the baby fat is gone, and her freckles are fading away.
It's a complete rewrite.
Fiona the Night Steed even points out that Agatha's actual scent has changed. She smells different, like a mature mare rather than a young filly.
Her body literally rewrote its own biology to accommodate the identity she forced to the surface. She didn't just remember Redmayne. She physically became her again.
The best way to visualize this process is to think about updating a computer's operating system while trying to preserve old files.
Oh, that's a brilliant way to put it.
Thanks. Agatha is essentially downloading the new, highly lethal Redmayne software package because she needs the upgraded combat drivers to survive.
Right.
But she is desperately trying to partition the hard drive to keep her old Agatha user files, her compassion, her friendships, her morality.
And it creates this unique hybrid.
Exactly. As a result, she becomes a hybrid entity. She possesses Redmayne's lethal instincts and physical traits, but it is still the core consciousness of Agatha at the steering wheel, making the moral choices. It is a successful biological hack achieved through narrative awareness.
And we must highlight the brilliant irony of that hack.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Earlier, we saw Pelles warning Hama about the existential terror of the mortal realm controlling their lives. The idea of being a game piece was presented as a source of dread.
Right, the paralysis we talked about.
But Agatha takes the exact opposite approach. She takes a mortal realm trope, the magical kiss, and weaponizes it to hack her own biology.
She uses the game against itself.
Yes. She takes the very mechanism that makes them pawns and exploits it to gain the power she requires to survive the coming war. She turns the game's mechanics against the hypothetical players.
It is an incredibly clever subversion of the rules. Mm-hmm. But, you know, taking a step back as a listener, you have to wonder.
Wonder what?
Well, dealing with this constant dread of social engineering, executing magical biological hacks, and grappling with the terrifying possibility that your reality is a simulation. How do any of these characters keep from completely losing their minds?
It's a lot to handle.
The psychological weight is immense.
But they survive by doing exactly what humans in the real world do when faced with overwhelming crisis. They aggressively focus on the utterly mundane.
Which brings us directly to the stable scene. We transition from reality-bending philosophical debates about the nature of existence to literally packing saddlebags and listening to horses gossip.
It is a phenomenal demonstration of how to ground high fantasy concepts.
It really is.
Agatha, who is now operating in her upgraded Redmayne physical form, goes to the stables to prep the animals for the arduous journey to the court. And the conversation she engages in with Fiona the Nightsteed strips away all the epic grandeur and replaces it with deeply relatable, humanizing complaints.
It provides a fantastic moment of levity. I mean, you have these ancient, majestic, telepathic animals who have likely seen centuries of war. And what is at the top of their minds?
Sugar cookies.
Sugar cookies. Fiona's practically demanding sugar treats.
Yeah.
And the internal gossip among the herd is fantastic.
So funny.
Fiona relays that Pearl, another horse, is constantly complaining because Thomas shifts his weight too much in the saddle. Another horse, True, is highly annoyed because human riders always insist on riding flank to flank on wide trails.
Just to talk to each other.
Yeah. Forcing the horses into awkward positions just so the humans can chat.
The majestic steeds of this fantasy realm are essentially acting like disgruntled chauffeurs critiquing their passengers' driving posture.
Exactly. Imagine packing your car for a high-stakes cross-country road trip, and the car's dashboard suddenly starts complaining that you sit too close to the steering wheel.
Or that you really need to stop driving parallel to your friends on the highway just to wave at them.
It brings this massive epic story right down to a relatable, slightly absurd level. But beneath the humor, this focus on the mundane serves a vital psychological function.
It really does. If we connect this to the bigger picture, these seemingly trivial details are the glue holding their sanity together.
Hells.
Well, packing strips of dried meat, adjusting the leather girth on a saddle, securing provisions, these are tactical physical anchors. Think about how people in the real world handle grief or extreme stress.
They usually throw themselves into chores.
Exactly. Sometimes the only way to get through a panic attack or a tragedy is to force yourself to wash the dishes or fold the laundry or sweep the floor.
Just keep moving.
Right. When you are facing an enemy that attacks your mind and you are plagued by the fear that your universe is a simulation, you have to find something solid to hold on to. Focusing on the step-by-step logistics of daily survival keeps the characters rooted in the present moment.
It is the ultimate grounding technique. The internal monologue becomes, I might be a pawn on a mortal's game board, but right now the leather on this saddle is loose, and this telepathic horse needs oats.
The physical reality of the chore overrides the abstract terror of the universe.
Because it demands immediate, tangible action.
Exactly. Which prevents the exact kind of philosophical paralysis that Peles warned Hannah about earlier. The mundane saves them from the existential.
So what does this all mean for you? The true genius of the Merari Logs is that they utilize the epic, exaggerated scale of swords and sorcery to mirror our own very real, very modern anxieties.
We all experience moments where the world feels too big and too complex.
Absolutely. We all have days where we feel like cogs in a massive corporate machine or pawns in political and economic systems we have absolutely zero control over.
And we all deal with burdens of duty to our families, our careers, our communities that can feel completely crushing at times.
But the central takeaway from these sources is the triumph of personal agency within a restricted system.
Yeah. That's the core of it.
Hannah chooses to act and protect the innocent, even when she suspects her world might be a game. Thomas chooses to march forward into danger, fully aware of the psychological toll it will take on him.
And Agatha proves that even if you are operating within a pre-written narrative, governed by tropes you didn't create, you still have the agency to hack your own code.
You can figure out the rules of the system and use them to become the person you need to be to face whatever challenges in front of you.
You always have the power to weaponize the tropes of your own life.
But before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over something that expands on everything we've discussed today.
Oh, I like where this is going.
Peles warned Hannah that dwelling on the mortal realm, the creators of their game, starts an unstoppable, dangerous cycle. But look at the evidence. The king has already crossed over into the mortal realm, Agatha is actively manipulating mortal tropes to rewrite her biology.
The boundary is sinning.
Right. So what happens if the pieces on the board finally figure out the rules well enough to reach back across the void? If a created simulation learns how to influence its creator, who is really playing the game?
Oh, wow. That concept shifts the power dynamic entirely. It is the ultimate existential threat, not to the characters, but to the architects of their world.
Just something to keep in mind the next time you feel like you're following a script handed to you by someone else. Thank you for joining us on this exploration. We love untangling these complex narratives with you and finding the real-world value hidden inside them. Until the next deep dive, stay curious. And, you know, maybe give your pets a sugar cookie today. If they are anything like the horses of Merari, they are definitely judging your posture.